Successful people learn how to make their mind work for them. I'm David Nagel, and this is the Successful Mind Podcast.
Hey everyone, this is BT and welcome to Inside the Episode. Today, David and I are going inside the episode titled, When Someone Shows You Who They Are, Believe Them the First Time. And I had to look at that because that's a long title. So this was a really good episode, David. And I think that it got me thinking a lot about, you know, being discerning about who you let into your life.
100%.
And what does that mean if you already have someone firmly entrenched in your life and you can't seem to find a viable way to cut them loose? Like, I'm thinking about the person out there right now who might be considering what you said in this episode and thought to themselves, well, dang, I think I'm in that situation. What do I do now?
Well, I think here's the problem. When a person finds themselves in that situation, they usually go through a period of time where they're a little bit in shock. Like, how the fuck did this happen? How did I get into this situation with this person? And you're right. They don't know how to handle it because they don't know why they let this person in their life to begin with. They're generally not even thinking that they had something to do with it. Like, it's like, here's this crazy person that's in my life. Now what do I do, right? Well, why did you let the crazy person into your life to begin with? There's always signs in the beginning, but generally we ignore them or we make excuses for them. We're like, whatever. Everybody does this, whatever. And we don't see the signs. So I think a person has to first find out what is it that they're so attracted to about this person that they're willing to drop their own character, their own values in life to make excuses for somebody else. And that needs to be shored up first. Right. And this can be done in a short period of time. Like, this doesn't have to be done over a long period of time, but really see where's your own character weakness, your own character flaw that's going to allow someone like this in your life, because you have to set a new standard. You have to set a boundary with this person. And the biggest problem with these individuals, T, is they don't take responsibility. That's the issue. It's not like, let me back up on that for a second, because that's not 100% true. If you've got somebody that is really dangerous, they're a thief, they're a woman beater, you know, like they're a child molester, like they're really doing something really bad, that's totally different. Like, out, you're gone, forget it. You don't get a second chance. But if it's somebody that is like, maybe they just blew up at you, right? And it's like, whoa, I've never seen you, you know, scream at me before. You know, what's that about? Hey, you know what? I'm sorry. I got really triggered. I fucked up. I will check on myself and figure out where the hell that's about and not try not to do it again. That's totally different than like, I screamed at you, you asshole, because you're a dick, you know, and you're doing this, or like, that's totally different. The difference is, am I going to take responsibility for the behavior and work on changing it, because we all make mistakes, or am I going to project it on you as your fault? Is it going to be your fault that I acted like an asshole, or right, that I stole money from you, or, you know, whatever it might be,
sure,
you know? So, but then the person you have to set a boundary, and that's where it gets difficult, I think, for people, because it's usually the fact that they didn't set the boundary in the first place is why the person's in their life or getting away with what they're doing. Now it's harder to do it because you're emotionally attached either to the person or their story, and you feel bad for them, or, you know, you don't want to hurt their feelings, or their mother just died, or, you know, they're going through a hard time now. You know, and these are the kinds of excuses that causes the behavior to perpetuate, and then us feel bad or guilty about trying to say, hey, it needs to stop. It needs to stop right now, right? Or you're gone, you know,
right,
and have some accountability and responsibility to fix the situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like a child, like changing the behavior of a child. You want to start early to get that corrective behavior in place so it doesn't escalate when they're 16, 17, 18 and beyond.
Yeah.
This happened in my own life with my parents. You know, my dad had a really long leash when he was, you know, when he was first starting out in marriage, and my mom just let him run, and she couldn't figure out why he was the way he was, because she didn't crack down on it and say, look, this is a boundary, I'm setting it. She's not great with setting boundaries in that department because it's conflict, right? Which is where I pull it from.
Yeah.
But in my relationship with Steph, like, I was acting kind of like that early on in our relationship. And she was like, this isn't going to happen. So it was like a firm boundary. So it's really interesting how, you know, when I was thinking through what you just said, you know, setting that boundary, you have to understand why you didn't set the boundary out in the first place. And now that you're in it, it's not too late to set the boundary. You can set the boundary right now if you want, but you've got to be firm and you've got to stick to it. And I think that that's kind of leads me into my next question, talking about the book, The Laws of Human Nature by Robert Greene. You read a quote out of there that I pulled up that says, you see their actions not as isolated incidents, but as part of a compulsive pattern. If you ignore the pattern, it's your own fault. And then I loved this piece. People never do something just once. Can you talk a little bit more about that and what that means?
Yeah. So when, and basically he's referring to is either bad or inappropriate behavior. So that means that something's causing it. It didn't come out of a vacuum, right? So a lot of times a person will say, oh shit, you know, I don't know why I did that. I'm sorry. And we see this a lot with abusive people, right? Like women, especially who've been abused, but also men, where they've been an abusive person, the abuse starts and there's a lot of apologies for it at first. As a matter of fact, the remorse phase is actually part of the cycle of abuse that we've taught in some of our abuse stuff that we've done, you know, and I think we've mentioned it in other podcasts before too. There is a cycle of the phase that a person goes through when they're an abuser, where they go into remorse. They get kind of called on their behavior. They go into remorse feeling bad, and then they're silent for a while. There's no more episodes. What happens, though, is that over a period of time, they recycle into the abusive phase again. They go back into remorse. They go back into the abusive phase again. Because they're getting away with it, the cycle speeds up, right? So it speeds up, it speeds up, it speeds up, it speeds up. What Robert Greene is referring to is that this is being caused by something. This behavior is in them. It's the way that they see the world. They react to the world. It's the characteristic. It's a belief. It's a value. It's the way that they react, respond. It's there. It's not just happening once because something is causing them to behave that way. It's not coming out of a vacuum. So if something's causing it, especially with people that have any kind of emotional disorder, behavior disorder, mental disorder, whatever, abusive people, even people that just aren't emotionally mature, they're compulsive about what they do. It's not, they don't really have any control over it, right? If they were emotionally mature, they would have control over their behavior. I mean, that's what emotional maturity is. I have control over my emotions. I recognize them. I see them. I know how to control them, right? I was taught that as a little child. But if you weren't taught that, your fucking emotions are a roller coaster. And it's also they're also a steamroller into other people's lives very often. So that's why that behavior is compulsive. They don't know how to stop it. They don't know what to do. And it gets escalated in times of emotional tension or turmoil in a person's life. So very often they do know that something's not socially acceptable and they're able to mask it in the beginning. But then after a period of time, either whether they become comfortable or there's some kind of emotional uprising, they acted compulsively and boom, there they are. They're out on the table again.
Sure. And this is all learned behavior. It's like you're learned. Not born with this.
No,
like,
you're not
you
born
are
with
learned.
It.
So yeah, that's really interesting. You did talk just towards the end of that about crisis brings out the character in an individual.
Yeah.
And you talked a little bit about trauma and you said that it shuts off the conscious thinking part of the brain and they just go into this reactive mode. So how do you navigate that if you're one of those people who flies off the handle at the first sign of anything difficult or anything adverse? I know that I have very interesting reactions to things. Like if something breaks or like a glass breaks or something gets spilled, formerly, not as much anymore, but I used to get really angry and upset. Now that has subsided because I've done the work on myself. But if you're one of those people who is quick triggered around those types of things, what do you do to navigate that?
Well, if you're, you mean you're a person that's doing it?
Yeah, so I'm trying to flip the script a little bit and we're looking at it from the person who know, they probably don't know they need to do the work on themselves, but they react in such a way that's not okay. Earlier we talked about setting the boundary. That person needs to set a boundary. This is the person who probably needs the boundary set on them to realize it's not okay to yell and scream at the kids for you stepping on their Lego, or it's not okay for that broken glass or that spilled milk for you to fly off the handle and rip on everyone. I'm trying to get a sense of both sides of the coin.
Yeah, I think the person, when you recognize that you have that behavior, you have to ask yourself, why am I behaving that way? Why is my reaction to this trivial incident so exaggerated, right? It's an exaggerated response. And I'll just give you a little transparency into my life. So when I was a kid, my dad had a very exaggerated response to idiot drivers, right? I wouldn't say he was road rage, but it was there. You know, it was, you're an asshole, you know, jerk, idiot, can't drive. Like, he would get furious when somebody would do something stupid on the road. And when I was a young adult, I would do the same thing. And I remember when I started working on myself, somewhere along the line, I had learned about self-introspection and really looking at different parts of your behavior and personality and the way that you reacted to life and asking yourself, where does this come from? What is this? And I distinctly remember, I can see it as clear as day. I'm driving down I-94 in Illinois. I was going home from work. Somebody cut me off, and I went into this diatribe in the car, you know, with the bird and the whole thing. And I stopped for a minute, and I was like, okay. I said, is that really how you feel right now? And I'm like, no, it's not. And I'm like, why am I behaving this way? And it took me a while to figure it out. And I was like, oh, my dad used to behave this way. And I realized that my dad has that, like, here's this thing about my dad. You never know if he's pissed off or not, right? Because most of the time he looks like he's pissed off. He's not a person that talks a lot. He's a very quiet individual. And because he, at least when he was younger, I don't know so much now, but when he was younger, he would snap a little bit. Like, you'd see that he was angry about something. And his response to it was, he's not going to discuss it. This is the way that it is. You know, knock it the hell off, or you're going to get it, right? Whatever get it means. So you grew up with a little bit of fear around this. And then you're kind of apprehensive. So little boys want to be like their dads, right? So I kind of developed this persona, but I realized at some point it was an act. It's not who I was. It's absolutely not who I was. So I'm like, I'm going to be who I am. And it was uncomfortable at first. Like, I don't really feel this way if somebody cuts me off. Now, I'm not necessarily happy somebody cuts me off, but I'm not enraged by it. I'm more like, I wonder what's going on with this person. You know, like, I wonder, maybe there's an issue. I'm not acting as if the person's doing something to me. In other words, I'm not taking it personally. My dad took it personally, right? And I've been around a lot of people that when something happens, they automatically take it personally. So the idea is that you step back and you have some self-introspection and ask yourself, what is this about? I also tell people, here's another good thing to do. Allow the behavior to continue for a short period of time and watch yourself behave that way. Because it's a huge learning experience. If you can allow yourself, like, let's say you go into a rage about something, that's your thing, that you rage. Become aware that you're doing it, and then the next time you do it, kind of watch yourself do it, you know, like with your inner mind's eye. Watch your own behavior, because it'll be startling when you see yourself do something like that. And it's a weird experience, because you can observe it and still be engaged in it at the same time, but you don't stop yourself from actually doing it. When you do that, though, you'll step back and you'll be like, okay, I need to find out what that's about, because it makes you feel about this small coming out the other side of it. You're like, what the fuck did I just do?
Sure.
You know, I mean, I was a total idiot there for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like reality TV. It's like you seeing yourself blow
totally
up.
Is.
Could you imagine? Like, I mean, I actually got anxiety even thinking about that, like taking a step out of the moment and viewing it through a different lens as it's happening. You can see how you'd want to correct that behavior. And that's an awareness that anybody has the opportunity.
Everybody
to
has
from.
The ability.
But
to
it's
do
just
it.
A matter of you doing that in the moment. I think that is absolutely incredible.
I think it's also like, if you go back to like the Buddhist teachings and some of the yoga teachings and stuff, you know, they talk about the separation from the thing, separation from life, you know, stepping back and being separate from it. And also on the flip side of it, in positive ways, you hear it like with arts and entertainers and musicians and stuff, like becoming one with the thing. When you become one with something, you cannot tell the difference between you and the thing. And that's the scary part about it, because when you start to be aware of a bad behavior that you have, where you weren't aware of it before, you realize how hypnotized you were by the process, by the thing. Like, here's something that triggered me. I went into being a raging idiot over it or whatever the expression is, and I'm not even aware that I'm doing it. I think I'm completely justified in what it is that I'm actually doing. And then you become aware that there's something else and you step back from it and it's like, what the fuck is actually going on here? You know, that is so bizarre to see it. Because those individuals will also be the ones to look at somebody else that's doing it and then be like, what an asshole that person was. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Last week, you did the same thing to your wife, douchebag. Like, what the hell are you doing, right?
Sure.
But that's the way that they behave.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting you brought up acting, and I thought of method actors and how they go deep
oh, yeah.
into that process. And it reminded me of the Heath Ledger tragedy when he shot, you know, the Joker movie and
yeah.
he was so deep, he never came out of it. Like he embodied that character. So he wasn't able to separate the reality from this character he was playing. They were one and the same. It also made me think about, you know, sports people being in the zone. Like when they're in that zone, everything around them just slows down. In this case, we want to sort of separate and be able to pull back and look in and say, is this really how you want to be responding in this moment? Because you're causing nothing but havoc
right.
all around you.
Right. I think anybody is susceptible to being sucked into something if they go down the wrong path. Like if you go down a path, maybe you're an actor and you're studying for a role, or you just want to see something in your life. You want to experience something different. I'll tell you who said this brilliantly was Keith Richards. Was when him and Anita originally started doing heroin, they only intended to like explore it for the first few blocks. And they went all the way to the other side of town for 10 years. Like they explored every inch of that city. But that wasn't the intention, right? But some of the stuff becomes so seductive that the more you get into it, the more you can't find your way back out. It becomes your new world. That's probably what happened with Ledger. And it probably was what happens to a lot of people.
Sure.
And I think that's where a person becomes that in their life as a child, because there is no other reality to them. If they're raised in an abusive life, that's the only reality they have. That is their normal, right? So it becomes completely everything that they are in the world that they enter as an adult, because that's all they had when they were a kid. There is no separation. So that process of separating and really looking at yourself, the way you're responding, this thing, what does it mean to me? Why am I giving it that meaning to behave that way? It's a fantastic practice.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, kind of changing gears a little bit, but not really. I want to talk a little bit about the Jeffrey Epstein documentary on Netflix, Filthy Rich. I have not yet watched it. It's on my list and I'm definitely going to get to it. But you talked about some of the red flags that he demonstrated very early on, you know, referring back to the title, when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time.
Yeah, yeah.
Elusive was one of those for sure. He was a narcissist, clearly, extremely charismatic, and his wealth allowed him to get away with many of these heinous acts.
Yeah.
What was your take on the story itself from a human psychology point of view? Because I know you watch things differently than I watch things. So I'm fascinated to always hear your interpretation of what you felt was going on in that, understanding that this is sensitive information and we're not, you know, trying to upset anyone. But your human psychology aspect is usually so spot on.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I was actually a little bit disappointed in the documentary because they didn't dive much into his childhood. However, I'm not trying to fault the producers of it or the director or whatever. I don't know that they had all the information. I mean, they said where he was from, that he didn't grow up wealthy by any stretch of the imagination. But here's what's interesting. As you get into the documentary a little bit, and I don't know, there's three or four parts to it, I think. The original hedge fund guy who was actually running a Ponzi scheme at the time that hired him initially found out after he hired him, the guy had no college education. He never went to the school that he went to, right? He lied to become a teacher. He lied to get the job. But HR found out that he was lying and caused the owner of the company, it was brought to his attention. But because he was so brilliant and so convincing in why he lied, he actually came clean about it. He's like, I lied because I didn't finish, you know, and I wouldn't have gotten a job doing this. And I didn't want the school to get in trouble because I lied and I knew I could do a good job. I really wanted a shot. And they were like, okay, Like, I can buy that, right? The guy's got ambition. He's doing a good job. Like, he was making them a lot of fucking money. So they became brainwashed by their own bullshit, their own convincing of themselves that this was a good guy, not actually going, but he lied, right? He lied to do something. So that's where Green's work will come in and say, it's compulsive. If it happened once, it's going to happen again. And of course, you know, he took $65 million from that guy at one point. There was a whole, and then another thing is that he wormed his way into people's life, found their weakness, exploited their weakness back to them, and then used it against him. That's why he didn't think he could be caught, because apparently there were a lot of people that had this sexual weakness that he had, and who knows what else. And he was supplying that for people, certain people, not everybody, right? So a lot of people have been associated with it with no proof, but there are also a lot of people have been associated with it that it did. And these were people in high places. Like he was, he's hanging around Clinton. He was hanging around Prince Andrew. A lot of people were involved in not having anything exposed or being associated with him. So at high levels, when it would get reported, it was dropped. The Palm Beach Police Department were astounded to find out that the case had been basically brought to a deal under the table, and they were out. Like, they were out. At first, when they went to the FBI and the FBI cut them out, they're like, we can't tell you any more information. Just out of the blue. And the guy's like, I'm a chief of police for like 15 years. Excuse me. I've never heard of anything like that. Right. And they were like, well, we can't tell you anything else. So he was very smart, very charismatic, very much a narcissist, and he knew what he was doing way before he started dealing with high-level people. What I think would be fascinating is to find out how he got that way. So this was like my first dive into this. I stumbled across it by accident and decided to watch it and see what it was. I haven't done anything else. I haven't read anything. I haven't seen any podcasts. I don't know if there's any other information out there. So that's all I know as far as that goes. But yeah, the flags were there right from the very beginning. And the guy that they interview, the guy who they gave him his first job and helped him become a billionaire, basically. And the guy says, my biggest regret in life is that I got involved with this guy in any means whatsoever, because none of these kids would have been abused had I not done that. I gave him the power to be able to do that. But he didn't know he was doing that.
Right. You know, and how would you be able to know that in the moment?
You wouldn't know that the guy was that sadistic. No. Right.
Right. Yeah. It's just, you know, that's interesting you bring up, you know, the childhood stuff, because even the podcasts that I've listened to, there's nothing that talks about his upbringing. It's really.
Oh, really?
And I've got a couple of podcast recommendations I would definitely encourage people to check out if they want to dive further into this. Like I said, it does get a little bit difficult, the subject matter and the content, but there's one that's called The Mysterious Mr. Epstein. That's a pretty deep dive into Jeffrey Epstein's life. And that's put on by Wondery, which is a really big podcasting production company. And then there's another one that ABC News did based off of one of their, you know, some, you know, the work they did on a television show called Truth and Lies. That's another, those are two really good ones. I went down an Epstein hole after he had passed away, and then learned more and more about these things that he was doing, and it was just shocking. So next on my list, of course, is that Netflix documentary.
Got it.
You have to be extremely aware of manipulation in these instances that you've been talking about through the episode and what you just mentioned around that Epstein piece. What are some telltale signs that you may be in a toxic situation, and could you maybe share some strategies that could help a person, you know, through it at the most basic level? Not to go too deep, but, you know, how do you know if you're in a toxic situation, and what do you do to break out of it?
So this is a great question. I think there's basically two levels to this. One is that it's obvious. Somebody's beating you, screaming at you, keeping you in the house, sexually molesting you. You know, it's overt toxicity. It's the covert stuff that is hard to find, hard to identify. The simple fact that you probably feel something is not right is the flag.
Intuition.
Is the flag. Yeah, you feel something's off with this person, or something's off in this relationship. Things don't make sense. You don't know how they don't make sense. You just know that they don't, right? There's little holes and gaps and stories and behavior. It's that initial thing. Like, if you can catch yourself there, you're going to save yourself a world of hurt. Because that's where, you know, generally it's like, if you think something's wrong, something's probably wrong, right? Unless you have a history of being a hypochondriac around everything where you find out, no, nothing, I was just making up my imagination. Generally, we're pretty accurate. When something's not right, something's not right. And ask yourself, when you feel that, do you find yourself making excuses for it? Like, probably just, there's nothing to really worry about, or, you know, or do you actually investigate, right? There's nothing wrong with verifying. Verify, right? Verify. If you're wrong, you're wrong. But if you don't verify, you never learn what's actually going on inside yourself. I mean, I think that's part of the process of getting to know ourselves. When we're little kids, and I've talked about this, especially in live events for years, we're basically taught like stranger danger, right? Just stay away from strangers. They don't really say anything more other than a stranger could be dangerous. Generally, a child doesn't have the ability to evaluate strangers. Most adults don't have the ability to evaluate strangers. So how is a child going to do it? But when we get introduced into, we have to let some strangers into our life, how do we do that? It's usually with the premise that the person's nice. So mom or dad will say, well, no, this person's nice. They're okay. But do they ever actually teach us a value beyond nice to go with? And usually they don't. I wasn't. Right. I was not, right? So nice was a value to me. If somebody was nice, I let them into my life. And then I would have problems and not know why I'm having problems with this person. Well, I didn't evaluate them, but nobody ever told me how or that I needed to. They just seemed like a nice person. Huge middle class, working class value. Oh, they're nice. They're nice. So we let people in our life that we shouldn't actually trust. So I think what we need to do is we need to go back and really take a look at how do we evaluate an individual so that we're evaluating the true character of a person versus what we want to see. You know, most of us are so worried about what other people think that even if we have some training in this, we have a tendency to let our defenses down because we want to be liked. We want to be accepted, especially if the person's presenting something that we want. Those big things are love, sex, opportunity, money, advancement, you know, where you are wanting something so bad, you're willing to do anything to get it outside of reason, you know, you're susceptible. You're really putting yourself, I mean, that's how people get conned all the time. People make something look so too good to be true. And the old saying is, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. And that's usually very, very accurate.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I just keep hearing in your words playing in my head, like nice is not a value.
It's not a value.
Nice is not, a value. Yet when they interview the next door neighbor of the serial killer, oh, he was nice. He was quiet.
100%.
Kept to himself. Like he was nice. Never an issue. Well, nice people can do horrible things.
How did the people in the town that Ted Kavinsky used to go to, they all said he was a nice
totally.
Guy.
Teddy
nice
K
guy.
Was a man. Yeah, he was so nice. Yeah, right?
If you look at any of the people that ran the cults in the beginning, they were all nice.
Yeah.
They were all nice. Jim Jones, he was a nice guy. People loved him.
Sure.
You know, when he was in San Francisco and he was doing the People's Church and all that stuff, everybody loved him. The crazy person came out over time, but see, too late. You're already indoctrinated, right? So now you got to make excuses to cover up your own behavior. Not a good situation to be in.
No, not at all. Well, That's great. I just got a couple of book recommendations. I've been really doing, it's so interesting that this is coming up on the podcast now because I just finished reading a book called If You Tell by Greg Olson. Write it down, take a look at it. I died to know what your take is on it. Basically, the synopsis is you've got this family. The mother is absolutely an atrocious human being who does awful things to not only your family by way of abuse, but the things she can get other people to do, even though she has treated them like absolute garbage. She basically, it's kind of like boot camp. She breaks them, she brings them in under nice premise, strips them down till they're just nothing, and then she gets them to do awful things. There's murder involved. There's horrific abuse involved. It's not for the faint of heart.
Is this a true story?
This is a true story.
Really?
Yes. It's called If You Tell, True Story of Murder, Family Secrets, and the Unbreakable Bond of Sisterhood. It takes place out in the Pacific Northwest. You're going to love the psychology behind it. And like I said, to our listeners out there, it's not for everyone, but I absolutely went through this thinking a lot of the work that you've done if you head them off or get to them at the right amount of time and set that boundary, a lot of these things don't happen down the road.
100%.
And that's what this story is all about. And then another book I'm reading currently is called Spilled Milk. Similar situation as well. It's written more novel style, but it's by the author is K.L. Randis. K.L. Randis. And that particular book is more about sexual abuse within a family. But it's
R-A-N-D-I-S?
R-A-N-D-I-S. Yeah. Check those two books out as how they complement this particular episode, because like we said in this you know episode, David says, when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. So we've got a lot of recommendations on this one, but
yeah, we do.
This is good. Thanks for coming inside, David.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to the Successful Mind Podcast. And if you like what you heard and you want to know more, go to davidnagel.com/freestuff.